kind of very briefly review what we studied last week, and then we'll study a different topic, and I'll explain that in a minute. So just as our review from last week, we were studying when the Jews, they had, if you will, a trial, a mock trial of Jesus in the morning, in fact, before the morning, in the house of the high priest, both Caiaphas and Ananias. And they then brought him to, brought Jesus to Pilate. And as it was mentioned, the Jews had said they could not kill Jesus, which wasn't quite correct. They could, under Jewish law, they could have Jesus killed, they could have him stoned. But they could not have Jesus crucified. Only the Romans could sentence a man to crucifixion. So they bring him to, as we studied last week, they brought him to Pilate. They were in some ways expecting Pilate to just sort of rubber stamp this thing. They thought, oh, they just bring Jesus to Pilate. Say, in fact, it's interesting because from the Jewish perspective, their charges against Jesus was claiming to be God, was blasphemy. Now, the Romans, blasphemy would be, basically, they'd say to the Jews, this is your problem, not ours. So what they do is they accuse Jesus of sedition. In fact, they say that he's perverting the nation and, of course, doing the ultimate crime, which was preventing people from paying taxes, which I think today in our government's view is maybe is the ultimate crime for them also. But that's the charge they tell Pilate. And because of their past experience with Pilate, they were, if you will, confident that Pilate would simply say, sure, have him crucified. And the reason for that was Pilate's reputation was very cruel. Judea was not, if you will, the high selection to be a Roman governor of. In the past, in fact, Pilate had been known for, if you will, sort of stirring the pot and causing a little situation to kind of grow a little bit and then essentially killing people, almost to prove that he had the power to stop sedition. So to him, sedition was very, very important to prevent. In fact, this area of Judea was notorious for having problems, political problems. If you remember in the book of Acts, when Peter and John are brought before the Sanhedrin, and if you remember Gamaliel, one of the teachers speaking to the rest of the Sanhedrin, remind them that how in the past there were men who claimed to be someone great, started a sedition, but were stopped. In fact, the names he mentions in, if you ever look at Acts chapter 5, starting verse 35, Gamaliel talks about Thaddeus boasting to be himself to be someone who, with a number of men, about 400, joined themselves who were slain. Then he talks about Judas of Galilee in the days of the taxing, drew away many people and also perished. So again, this area of Judea is known for problems, political problems. So as we know, they bring Jesus to Pilate. Pilate examines him. It's almost the impression, my personal opinion, Pilate does not understand why they're bringing Jesus to him in the first place. You have to wonder if Pilate gets a little suspicious of saying, are you trying to get me into a situation where I'll, if you will, stir the pot and do something that you can bring back to me and say, oh, Pilate killed an innocent man. So Pilate does, as I mentioned last week, what all politicians do. When he sees an opportunity to avoid making a decision, he passes it on to somebody else. Finds out Jesus is from Galilee. Herod is there, who is the Jewish governor of Galilee. So he hands Jesus to Herod. We know Herod really doesn't care. He wants to see Jesus do a miracle to entertain him. He mocks Jesus and returns him back to Pilate. Pilate again examines Jesus. And it's obviously there's something, Pilate sees something unique about Jesus. And so he goes back to the Jews and says, you know, this is an innocent man. Why are you doing this? And of course, we also know that Pilate, in an effort to convince the Jews to not kill Jesus, takes, in fact, a known revolutionary, a known person that has threatened the government, a known murderer. We're told Barabbas is a murderer. And says, okay, since this is Passover, since it's our customer to release someone, here's Jesus, here's Barabbas, which one do you want? Of course, we know they choose Barabbas. Pilate then says, what do you want me to do? Their answer is, crucify Jesus. And it's interesting, he says, so, you know, once he tells them to release Barabbas, he says, what do you want me to do with your king? And they say, crucify him. And then they say something interesting. They say, we have no king but Caesar. And I want you to just sort of hold that in the back of your mind, because this week I want us to look at that statement, that it comes back to haunt them. Another statement they make, and of course, Pilate then sits in the judgment seat. Remember, as in Roman court, to make a judgment, the judge sits in the seat, because a judge can actually question the witnesses, offer questions, but when he makes a decision, he sits in the seat. Sits in the judgment seat. We're told that his wife had a dream and said, don't be involved in this. I've had a dream about this Jesus. So Pilate washes his hands and says, I'm done with this. It's your decision. I'll give the order, but it's because of what you want. And it's because he says, I'm innocent. I'm innocent of the blood of the innocent man. And the people say, it's interesting when he says this, is his blood shall be on us and on our children. That's what the mob says to Pilate. In fact, you think about what's happening right now. It literally has gone from people speaking to Pilate to strictly mob rule. And Pilate understands when there's mob rule, you basically do what the mob wants. And you think about that statement where they said, his blood shall be on us and our children. If you think about us as Christians, that statement really is for us a blessing. Because as sinners, we always talk about these people there crucified Jesus. We talk about these people in the first century, they were mobbed, they crucified Jesus. But let's be honest with ourselves. Don't we crucify Jesus? By our sins, don't we drive the nails into Jesus' hands? It's because of us, you and me, that Jesus had to die on the cross. So his blood is on us. But the wonderful thing about the fact that the blood is on us is because by his blood, we are forgiven for our sins. In fact, we're told that by his blood, we are washed whiter than snow. So you think about these people when the statement that they made about the fact that the blood of Jesus would be on they and their children, saying they took responsibility, the blessing is we take responsibility too. And by taking responsibility, we have forgiveness. So the gift of Christ. So that's a review of last week. So if you look at your outline, the next chapter in the outline is the crucifixion of Jesus, the actual crucifixion of Jesus. And Nathan has prepared a great lesson on it, and so I won't steal Nathan's thunder. Nathan's voice is returning. So I promised him I would not talk about the crucifixion this week, so I'm not going to talk about the crucifixion this week. And also, since it's Mother's Day, you probably don't want us to talk about the crucifixion, because you probably won't be able to eat dinner. It is an emotional, passionate event that occurs. And really, Nathan does an excellent job. And again, I kind of forewarn you, we really need to listen to what it was like. You know, we tend to sugarcoat it. We need to take the sugarcoating off and realize the price that was paid for us, for you and me. So that aside, let me talk about something else this week. As I mentioned, I want to talk about that statement the people made, that they said, we have no king but Caesar. That statement the people made. And I want to talk about what happened to the Jews when Caesar came. They said they had no king but Caesar. So finally, Caesar actually came to Jerusalem in 70 AD. And what happened was, on that day, Judaism, the physical Judaism, ceased for all time. So I want to talk about the destruction of Jerusalem. I want to talk about also the end of temple worship. And also, I want to talk about, at the end of my lesson, and is How is it possible that when we talk about the end of Jerusalem, the destruction of the temple, how is it possible that people can reconcile that event and still practice Judaism today? I think that's important because we will meet people who are practicing Judaism, and you need to understand is how do they resolve that fact? How do they resolve the fact that with the destruction of the temple, sacrificial worship ended, and yet they still claim to be Jews today? So we'll talk about that. In fact, I'll ask you, if you in the back, if you will, when the bell rings, please raise your hand so I can, because I can't hear the bell from here. So Bill, if can you do that for me? So let's talk about this. So the Bible tells us when Jesus died on the cross. In fact, I'll ask this question: when Jesus died on the cross, what happened to the old covenant? Pardon? Yeah, you said it perfectly. It was fulfilled. It's like a testament. Part of the old covenant was a promise made that a Messiah would come. And so when the Messiah came and fulfilled the covenant was a promise of forgiveness, that there would be a sacrifice once and for all. So that when Jesus died on the cross, that covenant completed. And of course we know part of that covenant was temple worship. Part of the law of Moses was the sacrifices of the temple, animal sacrifice, Day of Atonement, all of the traditions that follow that are written in the law of Moses in the first five books of the Old Testament. But if you think about it, if you look at history, so Jesus died on the cross, most historians believe it's 33 AD, yet 50 days after Jesus rose again from the dead, or 50 days after that, was Pentecost. And on Pentecost, the Jews still had sacrifice. They had sacrifice in the temple. If you extend the calendar further, in the following Day of Atonement, the high priest still went into the Holy of Holies and offered offered the blood of an animal. So we see the Jews still practicing the mechanics of the old law. Now, 2,000 years later, we can look at this and say, well, that was just going through the motions. They were still practicing it, although it no longer applied. And so, let me ask a question. What would it take for the physical activities of the old law to end? What would be required for the Jews to not be able to practice the physical, if you will, physical manifestations of the old law? You'd have to destroy the temple. What else? Pardon? Yes, death of the priesthood. If you no longer had a priesthood, then even if you could rebuild the temple, you could not have the old law. So you have to destroy the temple. You have to stop the daily sacrifices. You have to remove the priesthood. And understand, the temple could only be one place. The temple had to be in Jerusalem. That's where it was built. That was established. That's where it had to be. So the other thing you do is not allow the Jews into Jerusalem anymore. So those are the things that would be required. And so otherwise, you could still follow the physical aspects of the old law, of the law of Moses. So it's interesting when we mention all that. Let's turn to Matthew chapter 24, because we're going to look at Matthew 24 for our lesson. Yes. You didn't hear Karen, she mentioned the fact that because the Romans believed that in the temple were kept gold was hidden in the temple, they, in their efforts, destroyed everything, leveled the walls, and on the walls was written the genealogy, so that the priests would know, so the people would know who priests, who could be priests and who could not be priests. Understand, you had to be a high priest, you had to be from the family of Aaron. So you had to be able to trace your family. So if you destroy the records, then how do you prove it? How do I show you that that someone says, I'm of the family of Aaron, and prove it to you? So, Matthew 24. This is Jesus speaking. And again, the context is they're in Jerusalem. And Jesus is speaking. And it says, then Jesus went out and departed from the temple, and his disciples came with him, showing him the buildings of the temple. And we mentioned this before. This is referred to as, the temple is referred to as the second temple. There is Solomon's temple. It was destroyed during Babylonian captivity. It was rebuilt. And apparently it was not that impressive. When Herod became king, Herod the Great became king in a way to sort of improve his relationships with the Jews, he had a massive building program. And the temple now covered, I believe they say, over 40 acres of buildings. So you had this massive building and all this land around it. A beautiful building. Works in marble and in beautiful stonework. In fact, people refer to the Temple of Herod as one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. So this magnificent building. Many stones weighing in tons. And so, you know, so here's the disciples showing Jesus this building. You know, here's this impressive building. And Jesus' answer is, verse 2, Jesus says to him, do you not see these things? Assuredly I say to you, not one stone shall be left here upon another that shall not be thrown down. And you have to imagine what impression this left on the apostles. So we know about the questions they asked them. Surely it's the end of the world. The only way this can possibly happen is if the world ends. Of course, we'll read a few of the verses, but we understand it's not the end of the world. The destruction of Jerusalem and the end of the world are two separate events, and Jesus actually addresses them as two separate events. But as we mentioned, if the temple is destroyed, if that's true, if that happens, and the Jews are not allowed to enter the city of Jerusalem, then the religion that was established by the law of Moses would have to cease. You could no longer practice it. As we mentioned, the death of Christ on the cross ended it from the spiritual sense, although people were still going through the motions, but now it would end in the physical sense. And it's interesting, historically, only twice before, and I could be wrong, so you can correct me, was the Jews prevented from actually practicing temple worship. Once is Babylonian captivity. That was when, because of their sins, God took them out of Jerusalem and put them in captivity for 70 years. And they were allowed to return after 70 years of captivity. And also many of the treasures were allowed to return with them to reestablish the practices. The second time was in 160 B.C., during the Greek occupation. Antioch Epiphanes actually stopped temple worship for a time. It was reestablished. In fact, just to give you some background information, the Jewish holiday that they celebrate, Hanukkah, is to celebrate the reestablishment of the temple after a temple worship after Antioch Epiphanes. So those are the only two events that ever occurred to the Jewish. So they were very proud of their temple worship. So in 70 AD, less than 40 years after Christ establishes his kingdom, their practices are again brought to an end. And this time they're brought to an end forever. I had a dear friend of mine when I was in high school. His name was Mark Gaspard. And his grandmother suffered from Alzheimer's. It was very destructive. And it was interesting because Mark's dad, Marcel, this was his mother. I had met his grandmother, and again, with Alzheimer's, it was serious. I mean, it was mentally, she was not there anymore. And it was interesting because his father used to say, he said, my mother died at 60, but it took another 20 years for her heart to realize she was already dead. In essence, that's what happened with Judaism. In 33 AD is when Judaism died. It ceased to exist. Christ's death on the cross brought an end to Judaism. But it took another almost 40 years for the heart to stop, for it to cease the physical actions. Even though these were empty actions, it took another 40 years for them to simply cease for all eternity. Yes. And look at, for example, with circumcision. Here were, even in the church, there were those that had grown up with the Jewish practices, were trying to bring the Jewish practices into the church. And as long as the temple was there, they could point to the practice and say, see, we can go back to the practices. We can go back to what our fathers used to do. Because although we talk about circumcision, you have to take the whole package, which include animal sacrifices in the temple. So if you take away animal sacrifice in the temple, then circumcision is just a piece of surgery, if you will. Exactly, and in fact, that even addressed the question. And with Floyd's making an excellent point is the fact that Jesus was not from the family of Aaron. So people would say, well, how can you create a new priesthood? How can you be our great high priest? And the answer is, if you go before Moses, there's Melchizedek, who, oh, by the way, when you look at scriptures, has no father and no mother. We're not told about their parents. And so, again, he shows that Jesus is, and if you think about it, Melchizedek was both priest and king. And Jesus was from the house of Judah. So Jesus, again, could be that great high priest by the order of Melchizedek, because he was both priest and king. So let's talk about what happened. Let's talk about what happened to the Jews. 66 AD, the Jews believed they now had an opportunity revolt against Rome. Agrippa II had a fairly good relationship with the Romans. So in that area, it was fairly peaceful. The army that was stationed in that area of Judah pretty much was almost like a National Guard. They were not highly trained soldiers. They were pretty much there. It was pretty much a quiet time. So the Jews saw their opportunity. So other things were happening. So 66 AD, you go back 2 years, 64 AD, there was the Great Fire of Rome. So Rome was focused on rebuilding the city itself. Also, Rome was having problems in Gaul. Gaul was a very profitable area of the Roman Empire. So they were focusing a lot of their efforts on Gaul. Also, Nero. Nero started out his reign doing fairly well. I'll just be blunt. Nero was going nuts. And everyone knew it. And also, there had been tension in Judea. There had been some minor difficulties. So the Jews felt, Rome is distracted. We're really not worth the effort. So they revolt. And what's interesting is, in 66 AD, they actually revolt. They actually had early successes. They actually defeated the local Roman legion in the Battle of Beth Horon. So it sort of bolsters their confidence. They're able to do it. So they begin to, if you will, the revolt begins to spread, which for them really is not a good thing, because Rome realizes that if there's a revolt, you have to put it down. You have to put it down quickly. You have to put it down brutally, or it's like cancer, it spreads. So you cut it out. So they have a very simple solution. You send your best. So they sent Vespasian. Vespasian has not one legion, but four legions. And these are not local troops. These are battle-hardened legions. 60,000 highly trained, highly skilled professionals. And so Vespasian starts in Galilee and literally like a steamroller levels everything. This is to be an example for the rest of the world. Never do this against Rome. So at his side is his son Titus. So we have Vespasian and his son, and they literally, in less than a year, subdue Galilee. So they come in 67, 68 AD. The revolt in Galilee is crushed. They move to the south. They begin to establish a siege of the city itself. They begin to destroy the surrounding areas of Judea. And 68 AD, Nero dies. Nero has no heir or no appointed heir. And it's interesting in Roman history, 68 AD is referred to as the year of four emperors, because in a year, Rome actually had four emperors. Usually history refers to them as the barrack emperors, where, if you will, the Praetorian Guard or some other group that was in Rome would declare this general as an emperor, and he kind of dropped out, and they'd bring in someone else. So finally, in 69 AD, Vespasian is declared by the Senate Caesar. He is the emperor now. He is the Caesar. And so Vespasian leaves, goes to Rome, leaves his son, who, oh, by the way, is also, or will be, after his father, emperor. He will be Caesar. So you think about in 33 AD when the people said, "We have no king but Caesar," God sends them two. And so Titus now has the responsibility of the final crush of the revolt, to destroy, if you will, the center, the heart of the revolt, which is Jerusalem. So he lays, which is typical practice, a siege mound. He literally surrounds the city with a wall. Interesting thing that both Vespasian and Titus do. In 69 AD, understand, here's the Jewish calendar. Every year is Passover. What do the Jews do on Passover? Where do the Jews go on Passover? To Jerusalem. In fact, we're told, remember with Christ, when Christ was crucified, it was Passover. And there was about 2 million people in the city. So now, basically 40 years later, Vespasian and Titus say, fine, it's Passover, part of religious practice, you can come to the city. So they let him in the city. There is estimated about, again, about 2 million people. Oh, you're not allowed to leave. Understand, this is siege warfare. So they let him in. They don't let him out. The intent is very simple. You have more mouths to feed. You have a finite food resource. You now sped up the process. And that's exactly what they did. In Matthew, let's continue on Matthew, starting in verse 15. Now, let me just skip around for a minute. That's it. So I won't look at that verse directly, but I want you to hold your finger there at near verse 15, actually going to verse 16. So the Jewish historian Josephus gives us the record. After subduing Galilee, the Romans marched into Judea. Verse 16, this is Jesus speaking about, remember the apostles asked about, when the temple's destroyed, tell us about it. And so here's Jesus saying, "Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let him who is on the housetop not go down to take anything out of the house. and let him who is in the field not go back to get his clothes. But woe to those who are pregnant and those who are nursing babies in those days, and pray that your flight not be in the winter in the Sabbath." So here's Jesus talking about this very event that's about to occur. Jesus is speaking around 33 AD. This event is happening in 70 AD. Jesus is warning the Christians. When Rome comes, leave. Go to the mountains. As he says, don't stop to do anything. Get out. And you have to think about it. Imagine a pregnant woman or a woman nursing a baby having to leave her home and go into the mountains. And that's why Jesus says, woe to them, because of the problems they'd have to deal with. Just taking care of a child is enough, but now trying to think about taking care of a child where you're away from home. And pray it's not in the wintertime. Although this is, you know, Israel, where the winters are fairly mild, still, could you imagine being out of your home, hiding in the mountains in the winter? They said, pray it's not in the Sabbath. That's a warning to the people in the city, because the Jewish practice was on the Sabbath day they would close the gates. So although you saw Rome coming, you would not be allowed in the city. So the Jews lay siege to Jerusalem. And again, as most sieges are, they plan to simply starve the people out. Verse 21 in Matthew 24, it says, "For then there will be a great tribulation, such as never been seen since the beginning of the world until this time, nor ever shall be." It was interesting, as if you tried to escape from Jerusalem during the siege, and the Romans captured you, they crucified you. And Josephus tells us that there were times that from the city, you could look at the siege wall and see as many as 500 people crucified a day. In fact, Josephus tells us that the Romans crucified so many people, they ran out of trees. So as Jesus told them, never before or never again will there ever be such an action that occurred. Verse 22 is interesting. Jesus says, "And unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved. But for the elect's sake, those days would be shortened." So here's the siege. Here's people are starving. Jesus says it's going to be shortened. It won't be as long, because literally as the Romans typically would leave the siege until everyone was dead. You simply wait. People starve to death. And again, if you read Josephus, it was horrible in the city. And what happened was, those factions that were in the city, there were those that wanted to surrender. There's those that wanted to fight to the death. And literally in the city was a civil war. And as a consequence, the food resources were burnt. Not by the Romans, but by the Jews themselves. So the food resources, as Jesus says, force the siege to end earlier than it would have normally happened. So, again, from history, we're told, by the summer of 70, the Romans had breached the walls of Jerusalem. During the siege, because the Romans knew that the food supply had been reduced, they knew that, if you will, the men and women were under stress. Physically, they were losing their capabilities to fight. They began to, if you will, approach the city and begin to destroy the walls. And so we're told, in the summer of 70 AD, the Romans had breached the walls of Jerusalem, ransacking and burning nearly the entire city. The Romans began by attacking the weakest spot, the third wall. It was built shortly before the siege, so did not have much time invested in its protection. They succeeded towards the end of May, and shortly thereafter broke through the most important second wall. The second temple, again, we talk about the temple of Herod, is referred to as the second temple in history, was destroyed on, and they argue, saying, either the 29th or 30th of July. So May, June, July. It took them 3 months to break through the walls, get to the temple. And history here sort of has a few arguments. One is Josephus sort of says that Titus really didn't want the temple destroyed, that they threw a firebrand in it, and it started the fire. Most other historians believe that Josephus was trying to be a little kind. As was mentioned, the Roman soldiers had breached the wall. They found many of the treasures in the city or in the temple, and literally, as Jesus said, took every single stone apart to find anything they could find. Because you think about it, you had in the holy a golden lampstand, the golden table. You had a lot of the vessels, and a lot of the tools were gold. So you can imagine, here is a Roman army that, you know, works off booty. You find gold, and surely you say, has to be more someplace. And so, as mentioned, completely decimated the temple. Tacitus, a Roman historian at the time, notes that those that were besieged in Jerusalem amounted to no fewer than 600,000, that men and women alike in every age engaged in armed resistance. Everyone who could pick up a weapon did. Both sexes showed equal determination, preferring death to a life that involved expulsion from their country. All three walls were destroyed in turn, so the temple, some of whose overstone stones and their places of impact could be seen years after the temple was destroyed. So you can imagine the size of those stones. It also mentions is, and of course, Titus, after the destruction of Rome, of Jerusalem, returned to Rome. And in Rome, you will see, sometimes you see pictures of Paris, and there's the Arc de Triomphe. In Rome, you'll see the Arc of Titus, which was built to commemorate his destruction of Jerusalem. And on its sides, you'll see reliefs. In other reliefs, you'll see Roman soldiers carrying with them the booty they got, including, and it's right on the side of the ark, a menorah. The treasures they took from the temple that they brought to Rome. And again, just confirmation of the history. And as Jesus said, total destruction. Josephus, if you look at both those that died in the final battles, those that died as people tried to leave the city, Josephus claims that over 1 million people were killed during the siege of Jerusalem. It gets back to, as Jesus said, never before and never again will such a catastrophe happen. Think about it. 1 million people died. And of course, tens of thousands were enslaved. In fact, there are Roman coins that have been discovered that shows Jewish people being led into captivity. And we talk about the million dying. Understand, as once the Romans breached the walls, the defenders of the city still try to defend the city. Again, think of the value of the temple to them. Think of the fact that this land was now, to the Jewish point of view, being desecrated just by the Romans being there. And so they tried to do everything they could to prevent them. And as we've just read, men and women both tried to stop the Romans. This is what Josephus writes. The slaughter within was even more dreadful than the spectacle from without. Men and women, old and young, insurgents and priests, those who fought and those who entreated mercy, were hewn down in indiscriminate carnage. The number of the slain exceeded that of the slayers. The legionaries had to clamber over heaps of dead to carry out the work of extermination. Again, the Roman order was very simple. This was a revolt. It was to be put down, and put down in such a way that no one else would ever again try this against Rome. And they accomplished it. Interesting, as I mentioned the fact that Titus and Vespasian brought with them four legions of the Roman army. The legions were the 5th Macedonian Legion, whose symbol was the bull, the 12th Legion, whose symbol was the lightning bolt, the 15th Legion, the 15th Apollyon Legion, which was Apollo, and the 10th Legion of the Sea of the Straits, which was a bull. Each legion would bring with it its standard, its symbol. And so you'd have, if you will, legions that had a standard that had a bull on it. You had those that had the lightning bolt on it. But also, as our armies do today, you may have, if you will, the standard of your corps, but you also have the standard of your nation. Does anyone know what the symbol of Rome was? The eagle. Thank you. Pardon? Thank you. Someone read me Matthew 24, 28. Could you imagine, here is Jerusalem, and here are the standards of Rome. We see the bull, we see the lightning bolt, and we see in every single legion, every single group, the standard of the eagle. The eagles had gathered, and the carcass was Jerusalem. So, the destruction of the temple, also, as a consequence, the Romans forbid the Jews to enter the city. They basically banish them from Jerusalem. In fact, there is a place near Jerusalem where the Jews were allowed to go once a year, in fact, May 30th, to look at, if you will, the destruction of the city and cry over it. That was allowed by the Romans. Yes. Yes. Yep. Because if you think about it, if you look at the following verses, then because when the apostles asked Jesus about the destruction of the temple, they actually asked two questions. They asked, when will the temple be destroyed, and when will be your coming? Because think about it. If you were a Jew in the first century, and I told you the temple was going to be destroyed, wouldn't you think the world's going to end? It has to end. That's the only way. They didn't realize it, but Jesus did, that it was two questions. So in chapter 24, Jesus talks about the destruction of the temple. In the following verses, Jesus talks about his coming. So you're right. There are people that will look at it as one event, where really it is two events. So again, sometimes when we read scriptures, we have to put on first century glasses and think about, how did they see it? And like I said, Jesus separates the two and says, here's the destruction of the temple. Now, let me tell you about when I come. And like he says, when I come, it'll be like a thief in the night. You won't even know when I come. So good point. Thank you for bringing that up. So let me get to the point. Let me ask the question. So we talked about the destruction of the temple. We talked about the end of the Mosaical priesthood. We talked about the end of animal sacrifice. So you have to ask the question, how is it possible that people today can reconcile all this and still say, well, they practice Judaism? And as I mentioned, we talked about the priesthood. Remember, 1 million people died in the city. And most people were not of the tribe of Levi. Most were Judah, were from the tribe of Judah. That's why they were called Jews. In fact, it wasn't until Babylonian captivity that we read the word Jews for the children of Israel. Because really, Jews mean from Judah. So there was a handful of people from the tribe, from Levitical priesthood. Many people die. The priesthood collapsed. So how do you reconcile this? Turn to Luke chapter 4. So you ask the question, how can you claim to be a Jew and not practice temple worship? So someone, if you would please quickly read Luke chapter 4, verses 16 through 20.
Thank you.
So here we see Jesus going to the synagogue. And as it says, as was his practice, he would go there every Sabbath. If you look at Jewish history, the claim is, starting with Babylonian captivity, the Jews began and established the synagogues. So, and that was led by the rabbis, the teachers. So what the Jews say is that after Babylonian captivity, there was actually two, and I'll use the word, priesthood. There was the priesthood of Levi, this, if you will, the Mosaical priesthood, and there was the rabbinical priesthood. And those existed until 70 AD. So when the Mosaical priesthood ended, the rabbinical priesthood continued. So the argument they give is the fact that since the rabbinical priesthood had started during Babylonian captivity and had continued on, that's, if you will, the link they have to continuing Judaism. Again, that will help you understand when you study with people that are Jewish, that that's how they trace their heritage. So again, hopefully that helps you with your studies and helps you with studying with other people. So hopefully this was of value. Next week, Nathan, God willing, will have his voice back and will bring up and teach and talk about the crucifixion of Jesus. Thank you so much.